dialysis decision-making guidelines, caffeine and miscarriage, aspirin resistance, and an EKG review. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to The Nursing Show, Episode 6. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this episode of The Nursing Show. I will be talking about quite a few different things in the news and moving into a review of EKG reading, at least part one of that review. I think this is something we can cover in a couple of different episodes, and it's something that everyone needs to revisit from time to time if you're not reading ECGs on a regular basis. So we'll be looking at that a little later on in the episode. In the meantime, I want to urge you to head on over to the Nursing Show website at nursingshow.com, and over there you'll find links to everything I talk about in today's episode, as well as all of the other articles, links, and information that you'll find posted in the Nursing Show blog, as well as all of the previous episodes. You can listen to the show there, download the show there, and find the links to subscribe to get the episode delivered to you free and easy. You can also leave comments, questions, or corrections for me over at the show, either on the comments links directly below each posting on the blog, or you can reach me by email here at The Nursing Show at comments@nursingshow.com. All easy to do, easy to keep in touch with here at The Nursing Show. I'll lead off in the news from an article I found over at Medical News Today, and it's referring to the November-December 2000 issue of the Nephrology Nursing Journal, and this is for dialysis nurses and nephrology nurses in general, and looking at whether they are compliant or aware of the recent guidelines published by the Renal Physicians Associations and the American Society of Nephrology. These guidelines specifically direct dealing with dialysis patients and working with them in a shared method of decision making on their dialysis process and on whether or not they should be taking dialysis treatments and the different methods of dialysis available to them. The authors of the article surveyed nephrology nurses and nephrology nurse practitioners and found that indeed there seemed to be a need for more education about the use and application of these guidelines for shared patient decision making and would avoid some significant ethical situations. The importance is that nurses need to be advocates for their patients and need to be involved in patient outcomes since the patients don't meet with their nephrologist all the time and are dealing with their dialysis nurses and nurse practitioners much more frequently. And so it's important for the nurses in these units to be aware of what's going on in the guidelines for practice, even at the physician level. So it's important for all of us, I think, whether your specialty is nephrology nursing and dialysis, or whether your specialty is in another area, that we all check and make sure that we're aware of guidelines for patient decision making and treatment methods in our particular specialties so that nurses can be that appropriate advocate for their patients and help their patients make intelligent decisions about the type of treatments that they want to have to deal with whatever their particular situation is. That's what I take away from this particular article. If you have any comments or suggestions about how you follow up on treatment methods in your particular specialty, make sure you get back to me here at comments@nursingshow.com. I'll move along from dialysis treatment and nephrology and into pregnancy and looking at miscarriage rates and a relationship between miscarriage rates and the amount of caffeine consumed by the pregnant mother. A research study coming out of Kaiser Permanente Research Division surveyed about 1,000 women during their pregnancy and asked specifically about their caffeine intake from October 1996 through October 1998. The researchers examined the effects of the stimulant among the women who said that they never decreased their caffeine consumption during their pregnancy, and it found that women who consume the equivalent of two or more cups of coffee, or about 5 12-ounce cans of normal soda, had twice the risk of miscarriage. Also, the study found that the women who consumed less than this amount of caffeine had about a 40% increased risk of miscarriage. So the signal here seems to be that any caffeine is probably too much caffeine, and those who consumed what would be considered a normal amount of caffeine in a normal person's diet seem to have an even greater increased risk of miscarriage during their pregnancy. Just important to understand this and to make sure that you're aware of current guidelines for such things and encouraging your patients in whatever their situation to engage in healthy activities, especially during pregnancy. Make them aware of some dietary concerns. Make them aware of things like switching to a decaffeinated beverage if they do enjoy a particular beverage. All of these things can go a long way towards shoring up the patient's overall health and improving the outcome of their pregnancy. Finally, I will wrap up with a story that has to do a little bit with our tip of the week this week. We're going to be looking at ECGs, and this particular story has to do with patients who have cardiac problems and are taking aspirin on a regular basis. And what has been found is some of these patients actually are aspirin resistant, meaning that their platelets are not affected by taking aspirin the way that other people's platelets are affected. And this essentially makes the platelets, I guess you could say, slippery, makes them less likely to clump together and form clots so that they have some basic anticoagulation factor in place in case of a cardiac event, or to stave off a cardiac event. And what this study from the British Medical Journal found was that some people have aspirin resistance and actually can more than double their risk of a cardiac event if they have this aspirin resistant issue. Basically, they can be taking aspirin, but they have a risk of having a cardiovascular event like a stroke or a heart attack at 39% of the time, compared to patients without aspirin resistance who run the risk of a 16% chance of a cardiac or cardiovascular event. And this is from a series of 20 studies looking at nearly 3,000 people with existing cardiovascular disease who were taking aspirin to prevent the formation of blood clots. And what they found in the study was about 28% of patients in these studies were aspirin resistant. So that's important to understand, that we may have patients that are taking aspirin, and yet some of them may indeed be resistant to the effects of aspirin on their platelets. So something to keep in mind, something to remember, and hopefully I'll be able to find some more information to present in the future about how we can identify these patients who have resistance to the drug effects of aspirin on their platelets. So while we're talking about cardiovascular events and cardiac events, I think it's as good a time as any to move into this week's tip and trick of the week. I'm going to jump in here on ECG reading, and as some of you may know, if you're shifting over from the MedicCast show, where I've been producing a show for EMTs and paramedics for the last couple of years, you'll know that I've been a paramedic for almost 10 years now, and have been dealing with cardiac and critical care patients in the field for quite some time. And so this past week, as I continued on in completing my RN degree, and we'll be finishing up here in May, I ran into an issue when we were talking about ECGs in my class, and I helped out with some of the instructional process when we broke up into small groups, and ran into that age-old problem that ECGs just don't look like anything that you can read when you first start looking at them. And I want to say that if you haven't been reading ECGs before, or if it's been a long time, you need to understand that this is one of those things that is definitely a practice makes perfect project. When you get out there and you're learning to read ECGs for the first time, you really need to be systematic in your approach and take your steps, write them down, and follow each step methodically. And when you get to the other side, you should be able to then apply the findings of those steps to find what rhythm you're looking at. Over time, some of the rhythms will start to leap out at you, and you'll be able to look at a page and say, oh, that's this. Or you'll only need to go through a few steps of the step-by-step process to arrive at a conclusion about the rhythm. But until then, and especially when you look at rhythms that are more difficult to read, it still needs to be a systematic top-to-bottom approach. And following each step in line, in order, and arriving at your decision in that manner. And that's something that I do all the time. There are rhythms out there. You know, people don't present the same way all the time. And so there are rhythms that just don't look right, or they're combination rhythms that are difficult to read. And when you run up into them, even to this day, I still go back to the same old steps of being methodical in my approach to reading my cardiac rhythms. First off, I want to point out that in the show notes for this episode over at nursingshow.com, I've got some links to some excellent online resources and tutorial information that will help you out with reading ECGs in your particular venue. And what you need to remember is this is something you just need to keep reading them. You just need to read a lot of ECGs until you get good at it and you get used to the process and used to recognizing things. And there's just no substitute for that. So there are lots of great books that are full of sample ECGs out there. There are lots of sites where you can download PDFs of sample ECGs to look at and sample exercises. I've put a few of them up here. These are all free resources, so I urge you to check it out. One of them is from the University of Utah Medical School with one of the former professors there. They have like a memorial site up towards his cardiology practice and looking at all of the tools he assembled over the course of his teaching career. And there's a lot of great information there. Also at skillstat.com, which is a site that sells some tools for learning and teaching ECG reading. They also have some excellent free resources available on their website. And at Merck.com, which is a drug manufacturer, they have some animations of cardiac animations and ECG animations that may be of help to you. Specifically, the page that you land at when you click that link will actually show you an animation of a heart pumping and show you which portions of the EKG happen during each phase of the cardiac pump movement. So you should be able to use that as well to kind of help line up your understanding of anatomy and physiology with the reading of the EKG. Now, the EKG is all about electricity, and you need to remember that the size of the wave is based on the size of the muscle that is moving it, so that the ventricles are going to be making your larger waves, your QRS complexes, and your atria are going to be creating the smaller waves, as well as the repolarization that occurs during the T wave. And it's also important to remember that just like if you're taking a photograph and someone who's taller than you moves and stands in front of you, you are hidden from view, you are still there. And in fact, if you stick your hand out, this person will look like they are growing an extra arm and it will change their shape, much the same way that the shape of a QRS complex might be changed if there's another event going on behind it that's different from the other things in the strip. So these are things you need to remember, that just because something is covering up something else doesn't mean that the other event, like the atria or the P wave, isn't occurring. You also need to understand the cardiac conduction of the heart. You have the sinoatrial node, the SA node, the atrioventricular node, the AV node. Then you have your bundle of His and your bundle branches that move down and then come back up through the bottom of the ventricles to create the Purkinje fibers that transmit all of that power to the ventricles and tell those muscles to contract. And whenever you look at a strip from left to right, it is a passage of time. So whenever something has a longer distance between it, that is an indication that something is delaying conduction. The heart has normal delays built into conduction, but sometimes those delays can be increased through the death of cardiac muscle as the result of a heart attack, or as the result of some medication side effects causing delays in conduction. So these are things that you need to be aware of as well. I'm not going to cover P waves, QRS waves, or T waves. You'll need to go to one of the websites and learn the particular parts of the EKG if you haven't already done so. But let's move on into some of the basic steps needed for examining and analyzing EKGs. First off, you want to start off with determining how fast the rate is. And you can do this simply by counting the QRS complexes in a 6-second strip and multiplying them by 10. Okay, this is very simple and easy to do. Determine the ventricular rate. Okay, you're going to start off there. You're going to count them, get your rate. This may or may not correlate with what pulse reading you've gotten on the patient. It may or may not correlate with the atrial rate, but at least determine the basic rate you're looking at and decide, is it too fast, is it too slow, or is it just right? Kind of perform the Goldilocks maneuver, I like to call it, where you try to decide if this is a normal rate for a person to have. You're also going to then determine if it's regular or irregular. You know, do we have a normal beating pattern that is pretty regular all the way across? And this can be done as simply as taking a blank piece of paper and lining up on top of your rhythm and drawing a hash mark at the top of each QRS complex and then going down the line and measuring them. And if they're all pretty much the same, then you can say this is a regular rhythm. If, however, there is not regularity and you seem like there's a lot of variability in the distance between the complexes, then you need to determine if it's a regular pattern of irregularity or regularly irregular, or if there is no pattern and it's just completely random in the way that the beats are happening, in which case that would be irregularly irregular. You also want to look at your P waves and do the same thing. Is there a P wave rate? Okay, does that P wave rate correspond to the ventricular rate? And also, is there a regular rhythm to the P waves? Are they regular or are they regularly irregular or irregularly irregular, just like the ventricular rate? You're also going to want to look at some of the intervals, the width of the QRS complex and the P to R interval. And these are important things because they'll tell you about conduction delays that are occurring within the heart that are normal or abnormal. In your QRS interval, you want your QRS complexes to be narrow. From the beginning of the QRS complex to the end of the QRS complex, you want it to be less than 0.12 seconds. If you are looking at the P to R interval, and that is measured from the beginning of the P wave to the beginning of the QRS complex, you want that to be between 0.12 and 0.2 seconds. These intervals will tell you if there's a normal delay pattern in the cardiac muscle and the conduction pathways. Finally, you want to make sure there is a correlation, or if there isn't a correlation, what's going on between the P waves and the QRS complexes. And this is really just looking at, is there a P wave before every QRS complex? And also, is there a QRS complex after every P wave? So once you've determined these things, and there's about 10 to 12 different things you're looking at there, you're going to answer all these questions. And I urge you when you're first starting out to write them down, write the answers down, yes or no, what the rate is, you know, answer those questions. And then when you're finished, you can start looking at what rhythm, what official EKG rhythm or ECG rhythm you're looking at. As for this show, we'll save that information for a future episode. So stay tuned for another tip and trick of the week coming up soon on ECG Reading. And that's going to wrap up this episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show. And if you are listening via a web browser or some kind of on-web player, you can go ahead to The Nursing Show site at nursingshow.com and subscribe directly and get the show delivered to you free via iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or some other podcatcher that you'd like to try out. You can go over to nursingshow.com and find the feeds to go ahead and subscribe directly. In the meantime, make sure you check back with your comments and suggestions, corrections if I've made any mistakes, and you can do all of that via comments at nursingshow.com. And you can also click the comments link at the bottom of each article on the site, and that'll bring you directly over to the comments page for that listing. Leave a comment there, comment back on each other's comments. Let's get a conversation going about what you do for nursing. In the meantime, I will leave you with some excellent PodSafe music from the artist Carrie Cunningham. She has a song called Smile Again. I like it a lot. I hope you do too. If you like what you see or listen to, you can always check out her link in the show notes and let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. Until next time, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, saying stay safe and stay tuned to The Nursing Show. Take care. Just to see you smile.